Senate Committee on Local Government, Urban Affairs, and Housing Committee agenda for Monday, July 13th, 1981. 3 p.m., Hearing Room B. We're having a public hearing and work session on House Bills 2560. And a work session, but not a very serious work session, on 2521 and 2864. And thank you.
The reverse is red, so come to the west. This is the most outrageous partisan. Shirley?
Yes. I overheard a five-minute bill.
Meeting will please come to order. We will first take up 2560 relating to landlord-tenant relations. And we have a couple of people on that bill. You have in your folder a detailed summary of the bill, and one of the most significant things is the item at the bottom that says issues representative both landlords and tenants appear to agree that with certain minor changes the provisions of House Bill 2560 are acceptable. Proceed.
For the record, I'm Dina Sweeney, and I represent Affiliated Rental Owners Association, which is a statewide association representing local associations of rental owners. And this bill was introduced at our request, and as I have here with me Michael Taylor, who is representing Legal Aid, which is primarily the adversary when we are dealing with landlord-tenant issues, when the tenant's side needs to be represented. I want to bring to the attention of the committee that there's a House bill number up there, so we have had this worked out in the House. We spent hours and hours and hours in sub-meetings trying to get to a point where we had a conciliation, and as far as the association which I represent and the association that Michael represents, which is the tenants group, primarily low income, we have come to an agreement on this bill. What I'd like to do is very briefly go through the bill so that you can see what changes we've made in the Landlord-Tenant Act.
Let me also add here, I think each of the members of the committee has a hand-engrossed bill, and says up on the right, is in writing in the right-hand corner, proposed amendments of 710 on pages 2 and 3. You should have that. And I think these are amendments which you have proposed.
Right.
Right.
The reason we had these amendments is that we had a call from a member of ours, and there were a couple of areas that weren't very clear when the bill came out engrossed, and so we went back to the drawing board and made it clearer so that the law would not be interpreted incorrectly, or at least we could identify for the judge how to interpret the law,
okay,
what the intent was. Now you have, I understand, before you the outline as prepared by your committee administrator, and that is primarily the same summation which I have prepared on a letterhead which says Affiliated Rental Association. They're somewhat similar.
The committee members should have an explanation with the Affiliated Rental Association Incorporated letterhead plus the explanation from the committee administrator. Okay?
This bill is, this law in itself is extremely complex. And I do not mean to be doing this too quickly. If any of you have any questions, please feel free to stop me at any point. Anyone, Michael is sitting here with me in order to answer some of the questions from, he is a lawyer and could answer the questions from the specific legal angle and also on behalf of the tenants. I would like to point out to you that what we have done, we'll start right at the beginning. We have had a problem in the past of trying to identify whether a landlord was responsible for locks for a common area. And what we have done in the bill in Section 1 is identified that landlords are not responsible under the habitability section of the law for locks for common areas. They are responsible for the dwelling unit, which is that the tenant lives in, that is exclusive to others. And we have added here latches for windows, and if you will look on your amendments, we have made it clearer that there is a problem with egress windows in bedrooms and also on storm windows. And so we have added in on line 17, and unless contrary to applicable law, latches for all windows. And those windows are only to the area, that portion of the premises that the tenant is allowed to occupy to the exclusion of others. We felt very comfortable with providing latches. Latches are simple hardware. This does not mean locks. It's just simple hardware. So if there's any question about that, we'd be glad to go back through that. Now, on section 2, we have added a section which provides for access by the landlord when a tenant requests that access. The problem we've had in the past is that a tenant will request that they have a plumbing problem and they need it fixed. A landlord says, I'll be in at 4 o'clock, or I'll have a plumber in at 4 o'clock, and the tenant says, well, I'm sorry, I can't be home at 4 o'clock, you'll have to come after 6. The landlord says, I'm sorry, but I can't get a plumber in there, or it's time and a half, or I just simply can't get anyone after 4 o'clock. The tenant says, well, I need it fixed. It becomes a standoff. What we have done here is to provide for the language that allows the landlord to enter that dwelling, and how he enters that dwelling when the tenant doesn't allow him in at the time that's convenient to the tenant. Now, if you will notice on your amendments, this is the other place that we found that there was a bit of confusion. It appears in A, engrossed bill, on line 35, 36, 37, 38, and 39, that you would have to give a 24-hour notice every time a tenant asked you for something. That was not our intent. So what we have done is we have renumbered that section. Line 33, we have asked for an A, so that you as a landlord do not abuse the right of access, and that except in the case of emergency, this is present law, agreement to the contrary, or unless it's impracticable to do so, the landlord can give the tenant at least 24-hour notice. Now, in order to provide for the portion that I explained where the tenant says, I want you to come in, but it's not convenient for me to come when you want to come, then this new language has been added. And then we added in on line 37 all of those exceptions again. It was brought to our attention that oftentimes a landlord and a tenant will have an agreement to the contrary. They'll agree. The tenant will say, it's okay, come in at 4 o'clock. So we included that language in there. And by renumbering it, we set it out a little bit clearer so that you could understand. And then on page 3 at the top, you'll notice you go about getting this entrance when the tenant says it's not convenient for me by giving him a 24-hour notice and telling them who is coming in or what company is coming in. And then the other thing is that oftentimes repairs may require that person to come back. And so you don't have to continue to give them a 24-hour notice. That first 24-hour notice is all you have to do. And that person can continue to go back and fix maybe repairing a wall or something. Now, the other amendment is right here on page 3 at line 7 through 10. Please reinstate that. That was inadvertently taken out on the house side and no one caught it until we got over here. Those are exceptions. And those exceptions must stay in the present language of the law, and we just inadvertently got those dropped out. No one meant to have those taken out. Now,
that becomes a new. I was trying to figure out.
It just becomes 4 again. It just on your line 12 of your A engrossed amendments.
Okay, it just
becomes
all right.
The 4 again.
Yeah.
It just becomes the same thing as it is, except it goes back into the law the way it's written. Okay, section 3. This changes the non-payment of rent notice from 24 hours after you have defaulted of 10 days to a 74-hour notice after you have defaulted 7 days, meaning that you haven't paid your rent in 7 days. You now will receive a 72-hour notice to either pay or to move out. Both legal aid and the landlords felt that this was a much better way. A lot of people can come up with money in 3 days or get moved out in 3 days a lot easier than they could. And it also, a week is, once a person has not paid their rent in a week, it's pretty obvious that they're having problems if they get a week behind. And so no one had any problems with that particular provision that expressed problems. Section 4, we have reorganized the abandoned property provisions. Hopefully, we have made them more understandable. However, I must admit that trying to understand the Landlord-Tenant Act is not always easy in any way. We could probably write it in Dick and Jane English and
now
still not understand it.
Now we have to jump off the hand and gross copy to the original one to get on to what you're
right.
talking about now.
Okay, I didn't know you had a hand and gross version. Okay. What we have done here is provide for, what we have done is try to set out how you get rid of abandoned property a little more clearly. And basically, everything that is there is the same way as the law is now, except we wrote it more clearly. I understand that originally that was a 280-word sentence. And so what we have done is take a 280-word sentence and primarily set it out so that you could understand what you do first and what you do second and what you do third. I think the thing that is most important is on line 12, you will note that it says the landlord elects to remove the property pursuant to Section 9 of this 1981 Act. What we want to do is to point out that further on in the Act, we have changed what is called the FED execution procedure, and we did have to provide for a way for the landlord to get rid of the property. And so we primarily dealt with that in this section, along with all the other ways that they get rid of the abandoned goods or goods that would be treated as abandoned. Now, I can go back and discuss this a little bit further, but I'd like to go on with the bill so that you can kind of get to Section 9 and pick up what we're trying to do with this abandoned goods section.
Yeah.
I believe I'm on Section...
I'm
yes.
going to interrupt you just a second here so that we can take testimony from Representative
Fine.
Gold. And then we'll, if I've caught you, hold your breath.
Okay, I have another bill going in 780. May I go down and check that, Senator?
Yeah, we'll just get her testimony and then come back.
I'll be right back.
Finish this, because I want to get her before she has to come to session.
That's great.
If you can switch gears here in a hurry. So we'll recess the hearing on 2560 and take up House hearing on 3132 just to hear Representative Gold, and then we'll go back to 2560 again.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Shirley Gold, State Representative, District 12, Portland. I would appreciate it if you would permit me to bring Philip Fell
sure.
up, the administrator of the Housing Committee.
Right.
And I'm here representing the House Committee on Housing and Urban Development. You've been given, I believe, my formal statement and also an outline of the bill showing existing law, outlining existing law and also the changes that we made on the House side. What I propose to do is actually read through the formal statement, because it does. The formal statement does pick up the important points of the bill, and then if it's your pleasure, we can get into more detail through using the outline. So the outline is on the stationery of the Housing Committee, you'll notice, and the my statement is on my own. I'm here today to present to you House Bill 3132, the Oregon Condominium Act, which passed out of the House by a 51-2 vote. The House Committee on Housing and Urban Development worked on this legislation for several months, accommodating the concerns of interested parties. The bill establishes procedures for the smooth development and maintenance of condominium communities in the state of Oregon. It outlines the rights and responsibilities of developers, unit purchasers, and the homeowners association from the period of the initial sale of units through the final turnover of administrative control to the homeowners association. Additionally, the bill provides greater consumer protection by requiring more thorough disclosure so that unit purchasers better understand the obligations they incur with a condominium lifestyle. One of the greatest recurring problems in condominium living has been the homeowners association's inability to govern itself. House Bill 3132 addresses this problem as well. You have before you, as I already mentioned, a section-by-section comparison of the changes which House Bill 3132 makes in current condominium law. I would like to take a few more minutes of your time to discuss with you those changes which the House Committee feels are most significant out of the total. The bill requires the additional information which must be disclosed to prospective purchasers to be included in both the declaration and the bylaws. For those of you who may be unfamiliar with condominium terminology, it is useful to think of the declaration as the condominium constitution, while the bylaws might be viewed as statutory provisions. Under current law, a declarant is not required to reveal any limitations on a purchaser's right to transfer his or her unit. House Bill 3132 requires any such limitations to appear in the declaration, which is Section 4, Section 4 being on page 5, lines 6 and 7, and also on the portion referred to, also on page 5, lines 15 to 17. I'm referring to the A. Engrossed bill. Section 9 of the bill, and here I'm referring specifically to page 9, lines 26 to 28 of the bill, requires any limitations on the use or occupancy of units to be spelled out in the bylaws. Simply requiring additional data to appear in these documents does not, of course, guarantee access. Accordingly, the bill requires the Homeowners Association to retain a copy of the declaration, bylaws, association rules and regulations, the current operating budget, and an annual financial statement. We're referring to Section 11, and specifically we're referring to on page 10, lines 29 through 39, page 11, lines 21 through, I'm sorry, lines 1 through 22. All of this data is available not only to current residents, but also to prospective purchasers who wish to be informed purchasers. Additional protection is provided by requiring the developer to deliver to the purchaser a copy of the declaration, bylaws, and any amendments to them before a unit sales agreement is fully executed. The purchaser's right to cancel a unit sales agreement is extended from the present 3 days to 5 days. In discussing those items which a developer should be required to disclose, the committee expressed its concern that no developer should be required to bear his or her private life to a person who simply wants to do business with them. We do not think this bill requires that. It requires only that people be given an opportunity to understand what they are buying. You would think, correctly, that many condominium sellers provide this information as a matter of course. However, many do not. The tragedy occurs when purchasers recognize unacceptable obligations only after they are locked into a 30-year, $80,000 mortgage. We think this is an unacceptable way to conduct business. Some significant clarification of the developer's rights are also addressed in House Bill 3132. The bill provides for special declarant rights, which may be reserved for the declarant in the declaration and which continue beyond the time of turnover of administrative control of the Homeowners Association. Furthermore, neither the declaration nor the bylaws may be amended to diminish these rights without the consent of the declarant. Under current law, the declarant must specify the point at which administrative control of the Homeowners Association passes to the condominium residents. There is no limitation whatsoever on when this must occur. To reflect our belief that the declarant should control the association for a certain amount of time in order to protect his or her investment, and that the residents of a condominium should ultimately have the authority to control their home environment, we decided to set limits to the period of declarant control. Section 25 of the bill, and here I'm referring to page 16, lines 31 through 37, specifies that in a single-stage condominium, the period of declarant control may not exceed the earlier of 3 years beyond the time the first unit is sold, or the date by which 75% of all units are sold. In a phased condominium, stage by stage, that is, This period may not exceed the earlier of 7 years from the time the first unit is sold or the date by which 75% of the units in all phases are sold. There are, of course, additional clarifications of rights and responsibilities contained in the bill. I'm sure that you'll be receiving testimony on those, so I'll not take your time now. I would like to briefly discuss some of the modifications which this bill makes to the existing law governing the operation of the Homeowners Association. As you will recall, I mentioned earlier that this is one of the greatest problems of condominium living. Under current law, amendments to the bylaws require a 75% affirmative vote of the unit owners. We in the House felt that this was excessively high and therefore reduced it to a simple majority of the unit owners. In fact, if we, as state senators and representatives, could only be elected by a 75% vote of our total constituency, I suspect that this building could be turned into a quiet memorial to unworkable voting requirements. I don't know if you care for that analogy, but anyway. Language in Section 9, here I'm referring to page 9, lines 6 and 7, Section 9 of the bill requires that all meetings of the association's board of directors must be open to the unit owners. Let me reiterate that I think these changes are basic to adequate self-governance. Section 26, and here I'm referring to page 17, lines 6 through 29 of the bill, requires the formation of a transitional committee to allow the residents an opportunity to participate in a non-binding manner in the operation of the condominium in anticipation of exercising actual administrative authority. This is intended to be an orientation period akin to an orientation week for students or legislators to acquaint them with the responsibilities they are assuming and the limits within which they must exercise those responsibilities. To go on, Section 27, here referring to page 18, lines 8 through 38, and page 19, lines 1 through 4, contains a list of those documents and data which the declarant must give to the association at the time of turnover of administrative control to the residents. I will spare you a recitation of that list and offer instead the opinion that the information contained in that list is information which we would all feel is necessary in order to operate our own households in a reasonably efficient manner. Finally, the last two sections of the bill, here I'm referring to section 32 and 33, provide a clarification of the insurance coverage which the association must provide and require the establishment of a reserve account for the replacement of common items. The committee feels strongly about the reserve account. Those of us who live in detached, single-family homes are keenly aware that air conditioning, roofs, and swimming pools eventually wear out and require replacement. When we buy a home, an estimation of remaining useful life and replacement costs of these and similar items is often a factor in our decision to buy or not to buy. In a condominium, however, the individual unit owner's responsibility for replacing common property is not so implicit. The establishment of a reserve account highlights the unit owner's responsibility for replacement and therefore provides an estimation of the cost of replacement as well as clarifying when these costs will be incurred. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, House Bill 3132 is a complicated bill. Our efforts in the House have focused on understanding the process of condominium construction, purchase, and operation. Pleased to have had an opportunity to appear before you to discuss those items in the bill, which I feel are most significant. I would be happy to answer any questions you may have for me. I'll also be willing to go through the outline in as detailed a manner as you would care to do.
Any questions for Representative?
Mr. Chairman, surely this, I understand, evolved from a commission on uniform laws for the, all of the states. Is that correct?
I don't think so, no. That's the other bill, which will be coming to you.
What was the genesis of this?
I think that Phil or Ben.
Well, you're going to test for that later. We can get these questions, ma'am. Okay.
I'm sorry, Senator Simmons. I only know it from the moment it appeared in our committee.
Any further questions? If not, thank you. We do have three additional witnesses on this, and we'll pick those up as soon as now as we get back to this bill again.
Okay. Thank you very much.
All right. Rush off and do good things in the House.
Okay. I'll come back if I can, because I'm really concerned about it.
All right.
Pass low taxes and high appropriations.
No. That's irresponsible.
No, that's Republican. All right. We'll recess the hearing now on 3132 and return to House Bill 2560.
Gosh, nobody's stolen a good name.
Now you can let go of the breath you're holding and resume your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record again, Dina Sweeney for Affiliated Rental, and with me is Michael Taylor with Legal Aid Services. And I want to thank you for the break, and I want to thank Representative Gold, because I was testifying on another bill in the House, and it was just timing was great.
Great, okay. The only good thing that will happen today.
Can't take this. All right, we just did Section 5, I believe. Is everyone still?
Page 5, right?
Page 5, Section 5.
All right.
Is that right? Did we... Am I moving right along here? Okay, Section 6 is an attempt on Roy 18 through 21 to provide for the ability to maintain your FED during a period which rent has been prepaid. Now, what I'm doing is explaining to you that under the law there was an inequity that if you had prepaid rent, like first month, last month, then you couldn't maintain an FET because the rent had been paid. So what we did is we went back into the law and tried to rewrite it so that now it is legal for you. If the person has done something illegal, under the Landlord-Tenant Act, that they now can, give them the notice, and even though they had prepaid the last month's rent. And it's really, I hate to use the word housekeeping this late in the session because I know you're sick of it, but we were just simply trying to bring the law into line because no one had called on it, no one had taken it to court, but it was brought to our attention by a couple of attorneys that it could possibly cause a problem in the future. Also, to continue with the housekeeping provisions of cleaning up the act, we found that on page 7, you will notice some of the dark line. We had to bring the law into line of some of the changes that we've made on notices on the complaint form. And we also noticed that last session we did not get the pet violation or the language irreparable changed to substantial from the 1979 session. So it was an oversight, and we have added that in along with the 24-hour and the 72-hour notice, which we have added in on this session. Now we will move to, I believe, Section 8, which principally adds Section 9 to the Act. And Section 9 is something that we have been very anxiously awaiting to get into the Landlord-Tenant Act. Presently, when you have to execute an FED, when someone has not moved, and the writ of restitution, which means that there has been a notice given to the tenant that you as a landlord are allowed to have your property back, and the tenant does not move, you are required by law to go down to the sheriff's office and post either a bond or actual cash to the tune of $150 to $200 per room to have the sheriff come out and make arrangements with the moving company and move these people out. We have done studies over the past year and determined that on an average, and I think some of you have received the Housing Reporter in the past, which is our newspaper, that it could cost $2,000 to $3,000 for an average two-bedroom apartment to move people out by the time you pay all the filing fees, attorney's fees, and moving costs. This section is an attempt to give. This isn't the section. Yes, it is. All of a sudden, I realized I think I've moved the wrong section. I'm okay. Self-help.
is primarily the section to allow the landlord the opportunity to now get the sheriff through by filing with the sheriff some fee that he will come out and move the tenant out, the bodies, and then you can go with a moving company or other arrangements that you make without posting a bond and move the goods to a place of safekeeping. And we have been very careful in writing this portion of the statute to try to determine that this, in doing this, that you must have these things put in a place of safekeeping. Now, if you would mind going back to the abandoned property section with me, which is back on page 4, I wanted to bring to your attention, 4 and 5, that what we did in allowing for this, what we call self-help provision, we set out how to handle those people's goods so carefully that we had hoped that a landlord does not get a slap in the hands from a tenant who thinks that his goods were not handled properly. We have under the present law where the tenant's goods are moved by the sheriff and a storage company to a place of safekeeping in a storage place, what is called an exemption list. And on that exemption list, there is primarily almost everything that the person could ever use or want on it, and they have up to 15 days to go get these.